The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Stephen Nachmanovich. Stephen is an improvisational violinist who performs and teaches internationally at the intersection of multimedia, performing arts, ecology, and philosophy. He is the author of Free Play, Improvisation in Life and Art, and he has a new book, The Art of Is, Improvising as a Way of Life, a book that the celebrated cellist Yo-Yo Ma noted, quote, not only gives the reader an insider view of the states of mind that give rise to improvisation, it is also a celebration of the power of the human spirit, which, when exercised with love, immense patience, and discipline, is an antidote to hate. I love that quote. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm so delighted to be here.
Although you are clearly preaching to the converted, to the choir, with regard to this reader and this book, I made a ton of discoveries while reading The Art of Is, and one of those discoveries came after I finished the book. And I was reflecting on my own improvisational journey and the story that I had been telling myself for years. And that story was that I embraced improvisation because it was an outsider art. But your book, in many ways, makes the opposite case, that improvisational art, be it musical or storytelling or movement-based, is fundamental to the way human beings express themselves in connection with other human beings. So that improvisation, in fact, is the ultimate insider art. Is that fair to say?
I think it's very fair to say. And when you say insider and outsider, of course, language is always funny.
Yeah.
But improvisation or improvising is really about the interface between inside and outside.
Mm-hmm.
And there are so many arts that have been outsider arts that have become insider arts, and the other way around. And when we improvise together, when we converse together, when we make sound together, we're constantly playing at the interface between my inside, my outside, between you and me, between, you know, what is part of my mind and what is part of the world around me. And all of that is a sense of intimate interconnection that we discover by doing it.
Hmm. My wife often talks about improvisational theater as being in conversation with its audience as well, because they play a part. So it's many conversations happening. And you know, I think one of the things that's a little hard for people to grasp on with that is that I think they're used to seeing great art as emanating from a great artist who's stuck in a room somewhere writing something down and then it gets revealed. And I think you make the case in this book that's not true. Even with artists who are working on pieces, that it does enter the world and be affected by the world around it, whether that's an editor or a reader or drafts or whatever.
Absolutely. And for that matter, sitting alone in your room and writing or playing the guitar or whatever you do, you are in intimate conversation with your parents living or dead, with your teachers living or dead, with all of your ancestors, with all of your friends. You're in conversation with the music you heard on the radio in the car today that you didn't actually like very much, reacting to that. We're in a constant state of interdependence and interrelationship, even when we're alone.
Mm. You start the book with a story of a very famous speech, legendary for so many reasons, that's actually taught in schools. But I certainly was never told that speech was essentially improvised. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, this was Martin Luther King's great speech, the I Have a Dream speech, on August 28th of 1963. And he was standing there at the Lincoln Memorial at the climax of this day of protest and demonstrations with 250,000 people listening to him. And he had a prepared speech that was written down by him in partnership with his speechwriter and friend, Clarence Jones. And that speech did not mention the word dream. And if you look at the film that, of course, we've all seen many times of that speech, he is looking down at the podium and reading the first seven paragraphs of the speech. And just off camera is the great gospel singer Mahalia Jackson, who had just sung just prior to Dr. King getting up to the podium. And she was an old friend of his, and they'd had a lot of late-night phone conversations about things that he was worried about, things that he felt had not worked. And she shouted out to him, because he had spoken to her on the phone, I guess, about a speech that he gave in Detroit about dreams that he felt hadn't worked very well. And she shouted out to him, "Tell him about the dream, Martin. Tell him about the dream." And you can see him shift the papers off to the left and look up at the audience, and he begins improvising.
And he's reincorporating, because this, again, what people often don't understand about improvisation is you are using everything. You are reincorporating, just as you talked about your parents, but other lines you have spoken, as well as stuff that sometimes does come out, you know, completely new.
Yes. And the format that he came out with that speech, of course, he'd given a similar speech before that he didn't think was so great. And, of course, this time it was quite different, but he was quoting from the Bible. He was quoting from the Declaration of Independence. There, he was throwing in all kinds of references, as we all do. I mean, you and I can have a conversation, and we will constantly, consciously and unconsciously, throw in phrases and quotations from things that we have heard and thought about. And, you know, the important thing is that everything that comes into us is digested and absorbed and becomes us. And that's what the nature of that improvisation was. You know, we often talk about originality in our culture as though it meant doing something that's all new or all different, or nobody has ever done anything like this before. And we have this kind of fake idea of innovation. And in fact, originality, I mean, I like, you know, we all took geometry in school and we learned about the origin of the graph. In the origin of the graph, that's where the x-axis crosses the y-axis. And for the human being, that's in your body. Mm-hmm. When you are the origin, with the things that you've absorbed and digested have become entirely you, you are the origin. And it doesn't matter if it's been said before or if other people have said it before. It's coming from you. And that's really the essence of what I'm portraying in this book. It's not just about people standing up on stage and making up new theater, new music. It's about how that theater, music, conversation, medicine, technology, whatever you do, originates from all of us.
So I want to talk a bit about this reorienting ourselves to improvisation as essentially a way of being. And you write in the book, quote, "I came to see art making not as a matter of displaying skill, but of awakening and realizing altruistic intentions." This is something I very much believe, because I talk about our Second City style improvisation as being human being practice, or practice in being a better human being. And I think that is similar to what you're saying with the altruism that's at play.
Yes. And speaking of the unconscious quotes, When I said altruistic intentions there, I was, in a sense, quoting from a common phrase in Tibetan Buddhism, where they talk about enlightenment, you know, that you vow, if you're on the bodhisattva path, you vow to attain enlightenment or awakening for the altruistic intention of benefiting all living beings.
I've talked about this, I think, on the podcast. I'm sure I've talked about this on the podcast, that when I started working at Second City, I didn't know that they wrote their shows through improvisation. I wanted to be a playwright. It was a theater. I like comedy. But I had done my thesis in college on spontaneous bop prosody of the Beat Generation.
And nice.
I know. And my thesis was basically saying the Beats were not outside, like I started this conversation with, the American literary tradition. They were firmly inside that. And part of the Kerouac's work was always this tension between the Eastern religion that he sort of, you know, got exposed to, and his inability to sort of escape his Catholicism. I think that tension produced some pretty great art, and also, you know, led to a pretty bad experience as a human being for him.
Right.
And I'm curious in terms of your, you know, you talk a lot about Eastern religion in the book, and but I don't know your upbringing. What was your religion growing up?
Well, my religion, I grew up as a Jewish kid in L.A.
Okay.
And there's actually a part of the book where I'm talking about the universal language of gibberish.
Yes.
And there I was as a 7 or 8 year old, 10 year old, going to the high holiday services with my parents in this very big temple in L.A. And my parents were part of what's called the conservative branch of American Judaism, where they would recite, they would learn to read, meaning transliterate the Hebrew letters, and recite at a pretty fast speed the Hebrew prayers, but without actually learning the language.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember being a kid, you know, we were all kids dressed up in our little suits and dresses and stuff, walking up and down the aisles and being kind of bored, and looking at all these grown-ups weaving and bobbing back and forth, davening, praying in this language that they did not understand. And I was thinking to myself, gee, you know, you guys, like, either learn the language or do it in English. This just doesn't make any sense at all. And then me and a bunch of the other kids would escape to the tropical fish store next door on Beverly Boulevard.
Uh-huh.
And and then there I was in my 20s, as a becoming an improvisational violinist and improvising vocally and playing with sound and playing with language. And I suddenly realized that all of this upbringing that I had in this temple, being exposed to this gibberish language that was on the one hand gibberish, and on the other hand it was completely heartfelt and sincere and serious, and people saying it with the feeling that it was the most important thing in the world. And I realized that this was one of the things that had kind of programmed me to become a professional improviser.
And you also note in the book that you often, when you teach workshops, you like to start with gibberish. Is that because you recognize that as your maybe your starting point?
Well, I recognize it as my starting point, but it's really everybody's starting point.
Right.
Because we have all been babies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and actually I stopped saying gibberish a few years ago when I went to Japan and I was teaching workshops, and I don't know Japanese at all, but I was asking people there about the appropriate word, and the translation of gibberish really referred to that meaning of gibberish, which is like you're crazy and doing, you know, insane, disconnected utterances, and that's not what this is. It's music. And I came upon the word akachango, which means baby talk. And literally it means, in Japanese, the speech of cute little red things.
Huh. That's wild.
So, and I realize that, you know, what this is really about, like, I'll often teach workshops for, you know, musicians who've gone to Juilliard and other extraordinary music schools and who have amazing chops. But very often I'll have workshops where there's a mixture of extremely skilled musicians and people who don't play an instrument at all, and extremely skilled dancers and people who move in a very ordinary way, and so forth, theater people, all kinds. So there's a tremendous mixture of skills among human beings. However, we have all had practice being a baby.
Hmm.
We have all had the experience of communicating truth emotionally through sound. And that's why it's easy for us to communicate with dogs and other animals. You know, there's a certain basic being part of nature, being part of the animal world that's inherent to us. And that's the language that we can build upon when we're improvising. And people can discover in these workshops that with no preparation, no instructions, really not a word, I often, if I'm feeling like I'm teaching well that day, I sometimes really don't say a word.
Hmm.
And people find that they are making interesting, emotionally connected pieces that may be serious, may be funny, that are made of sound and movement and words and whatever they bring into it. And the pieces have a beginning, a middle, and an end, and a structure. And they very quickly evolve to becoming artworks that are really interesting. And pretty soon they get to the point where other people can look in from the outside and can't believe that this is some, that this isn't some pre-composed piece of theater or dance or music or whatever it is, because it's so beautifully structured. And yet people haven't been given rules. They haven't been told anything. They haven't conferred among each other. They just start doing it. And we all have this capability.
Yeah. And this also speaks to this duality, which is words are important, and getting the right words are important. They're meaningful, and at the same time, they can be a trap because we start to define and name things, and then we kind of lose the spirit or essence of the thing that we just named.
Right. Right.
And you have a whole section on verbs and nouns in the book, which was one of these things like, where is he going with this? But it really was. I mean, this idea that you say, quote, nouns break the world and our experience apart into things. And talk to us, you know, about that, like what nouns are doing, and then the power of verbs to kind of unleash what the noun broke.
Oh, yes. Well, my mentor, Gregory Bateson, the anthropologist and philosopher, liked to say stamp out nouns.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to have a bumper sticker made that said stamp out nouns. And, I mean, obviously you and I are having a conversation and we're using nouns.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not about not using language. What it is about is not reifying or solidifying our reactions to the world based on, okay, this is a computer, this is a table, this is a book. It is about actually being able, at least to some extent, to see things freshly. I give an example in that chapter of my younger son, Gregory, when he was a year and a half old, driving with him around the hills outside of L.A., and listening to him shout, car, 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 every time a car drove by.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just glorying in his ability to say things. And it's so beautiful to be able to connect sounds and the world around us. But at the same time, we can get stuck in expertise. We can get stuck in feeling that we know what something is, and therefore we don't have to look at it anymore. So that when Ronald Reagan was running for governor of California in 1966, on a anti-environmental platform, which then became pretty much the whole Republican Party. He said, if you've seen one redwood tree, you've seen them all. So if you know that this is called a redwood tree and you keep a few of them, you can cut the rest of them down, and it doesn't really matter because they're all the same. That people of a particular class or category are all the same, that objects are all the same, when in fact everything is different. You know, I sometimes, as an improviser on the violin, people always ask me what kind of music I play, and I can say somewhat ingenuously that I was trained as a classical musician, but I'm interested in Indian music, and I've been interested in jazz and many other forms of music, but that isn't really a kind of music. And what I've come to say is that I play materialistic music. And, in the West, we think materialism refers to money. But what I'm really interested in is actual materials, the feel of the wood, the feel of the strings, the feel of the air around you. When you touch an object, even a computer or a manufactured object, it's actually unlike every other object in the universe. And the more intimately you relate to what that object is, the closer you are to the material of things. It's no longer a generic noun. It's a interactive experience of which you're part. And that's why the book is called The Art of Is.
The Reagan quote made me laugh out loud because I recalled Bernie Solins, who is the founder, co-founder of Second City, once saying to me, because people always would be like, well, you've seen one Second City show, you've seen them all. He actually said to me, if you've seen all of the Second City shows, you've seen one of them. And he sort of delighted in this absurdity of that, because his point was like, we've created a form that does have some specific boundaries and constraints that are necessary for these incredibly creative people to do a thing that you will never see again and that
right.
never existed before.
Right.
And isn't that's the experience that we want you to walk away with?
Right.
That's so interesting.
Right. So I
one of the things I wanted to get into is this idea of people who try to stop improvisation. A line I use in my keynotes is that, you know, I say improvisation is a superpower. There was a guy once who said to me, it's not a superpower unless it can be used for evil. And I think people can do that. But you have a number of areas where you discuss where people really did not. I mean, there was a theater act of 1843 where the British Parliament criminalized improvisation?
That's correct.
What is going on?
Well, what that was about was that in fact, you may remember if you've seen Shakespeare in Love.
Oh yeah,
all the way back there in Elizabethan times, the Lord Chamberlain
had to approve.
Had the right to censor theater.
Yeah,
if it was not politically correct. So in the 19th century, they passed this Theatres Act that criminalized improvisation because the Lord Chamberlain had to approve a script. And if you had theater without a script, there was no telling what might happen and whether somebody might say something that was out of bounds for the current powers that be. And so that was it. You had to have a script. And this actually was not, this law was not repealed until 1968.
Wow.
I mean, I don't think it was enforced in the 20th century, but still, it's quite kind of amazing, you know, that there's an intense desire to control speech.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and this is why dictators of all times and of all places, including present time, are trying to control speech, are trying to control the arts, are trying to suppress people's voices and have only the approved things said out loud. And so art becomes the final section of the book is called Art and Power.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really about that. Art becomes a vital life function for breaking through those barriers and giving people a voice and giving us an understanding of our connection to each other.
Yeah, and we should note, too, that, you know, there was this Theaters Act, but Hitler, Stalin, the Taliban, these are all destroyers of art that are very recent history. You also tell the story of Herbert Zipper, and I hadn't heard this before. And you met him, correct?
Yes, I did meet him. He actually lived, I live in Charlottesville, Virginia now, but I lived in L.A. for most of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And he lived not far from me. He died in his 90s. In the 1990s.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a composer and conductor born in 1904 in Vienna.
Mm-hmm.
And he might have been on track to become one of those great mid-century European conductors. But the Anschluss came, Hitler and his troops marched into Austria, and he was thrown into Dachau.
Mm-hmm.
And second or third night that he was a slave laborer in Dachau, he found himself just whatever they were doing, digging ditches or moving, I think they were carting stones back and forth across a road to build a wall, and he started reciting some Goethe.
Hmm.
And a couple of his fellow prisoners who knew the poetry chimed in. And there were other fellow prisoners who were had no exposure to poetry or culture of any kind, but who heard this poetry and stood up a little straighter and felt a little better. I mean, that's the most you can say.
Sure.
In a Nazi concentration camp. And he ended up starting a clandestine orchestra behind the latrines at Dachau. And they just played these songs and strummed on junk instruments, and the songs that he wrote actually spread from one camp to another and kind of became anthems of the prisoners.
Hmm.
And he was then bribed out. It was before the war started. The concentration camps were already going,
mm-hmm.
but the war hadn't started, and his father had escaped to London and had some money and bribed him out. And he went to London, and he was offered a job as conductor of the Manila Philharmonic.
Mm-hmm.
And he figured, oh, good, Philippines, as far from Nazi Germany as you can get.
Yeah.
And he arrived just in time for the Japanese to invade.
Yep.
And he was thrown into a prisoner of camp by the Japanese.
And oh, man.
Escaped and became a spy and conducted a famous concert in the bombed-out shell of the Santa Cruz Cathedral when the city was liberated again.
Hmm.
And, you know, there were other people in the camps who were like this, who continued to do some kind of creative activity and something that gave, I don't want to say hope because that's the wrong word, but gave some kind of encouragement and life infusion of life to their fellow prisoners.
So,
you know, this is, you know, the important thing is not that it was great art,
right.
Not that it was anything other than people exchanging, you know, some of the energy of life in the worst place in the world. And, you know, I connect this, of course. I mean, Hitler, of course, was very busy either suppressing art or else buying off those artists who could be bought off to do sort of safe propagandistic art.
Right.
And Stalin was doing the same thing, and there was mm-hmm. the whole years-long story between Stalin and Shostakovich. And, you know, the feeling that dictators get that they need to suppress art and that they need to suppress free speech and education and all the other things that go with it is so clear, because, of course, if people were able to breathe and listen to ideas and perceive art and music and theater and literature and all of that, they wouldn't believe the BS that they're being fed by the dictatorship.
Mm-hmm. There's so much to unpack here. We recently got hired to work with social workers who were going to teach them improvisational skills to help them better communicate and collaborate with recently diagnosed HIV patients from disadvantaged backgrounds, and because they're having a hard time even getting those people to acknowledge what's going on, and you know they can survive. There's medicine now that allows that. And I was actually doing a little research for this project, and I came across a group in South Africa who just published a report very similar, using and teaching their fellows improvisational skills to deal with rape victims. And people undergoing cancer. You and I were supposed to tape this a podcast a while ago, and my daughter's in the hospital undergoing cancer treatment. And my wife and I had developed this Improvisation for Caregivers program well before her diagnosis. And the thing that I notice in this darkest of spaces, that all the improvisational work, the idea of being present in the moment, the idea of making mistakes work for us, the idea of sort of celebrating connection, these are the things that are allowing us to live with joy at a time when you think there would be no joy.
Yeah.
And you get at that in this book over and over again, you know, that it's not just about all the sunny good times that, you know, so many people feel sort of improvisational artists, certainly in the comedy world, are experiencing. No, they're utilizing these skills to manage suffering.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so important. That's so important. And, we have this... Yeah, the word improv in America tends to be associated with comedy.
Yeah, it's our fault. Sorry.
And which, of course, is wonderful, but it's only one of the many dimensions of theater. And it's, I think, partly because John Cage once gave me the list of the 9 rasas, the 9 basic emotions of theater, music, and dance. And one of them is mirth. Mm. And when people laugh, it's audible. So it's a reinforcement from the audience to the performer to do more of that. But when people experience anger, sorrow, fear, feelings of courage, feelings of wonder, feelings of tranquility, all of those are present in art, in theater, in music, in anything that we do. And to experience what art gives us and what the ability to improvise and be present, including being present for the things that are really, really difficult, means that you're present for everything. You know, you're present for what is. You know, there's a saying from your field about, you're not, you want to play the scene that you're in, not the scene that you want to be in.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the art of is. And anything that we can do to help us recognize where we are and what's happening, both in our intimate worlds and in the wider world around us, is going to help us deal compassionately with other people and with the situation that we find ourselves in. And the compassion can be funny, it can be serious, there are so many forms that it takes. But that's the journey that we're on, is enhancing life, giving each other courage, and giving each other support. And we're all in this together.
And when you allow yourself to be truly present in the moment, your list of options grows dramatically because yes. you're seeing so much more that's going on in the room, whether it's a yes. noise, whether it's a thing that's outside the room, whether you know, and in the music realm, it's interesting you mentioned Cage too, because this I don't know enough about sort of contemporary composing, but the idea of utilizing sound differently inside composition, you know, whether it's trucks going or the music of a street, is rather beautiful and can be played with.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I want to that, you quote Brian Eno, and I love this quote, which is, he said, taking the sound out of the realm of the perfect into the realm of the real.
Yes. And Brian Eno also, in that part of the book, you know, there's this, he's in an interview with a somebody from Keyboard Magazine talking about, of course, in those publications, they love, as I do, love to talk about the tech of synths and microphones and electronic music toys. And Eno says basically that he loves to have, rather than taking a synthesizer to a shop to have it modified to do something more interesting, he lets age modify it. And this sense of like embracing decay and age and the surprising things that we can get from really listening to the imperfect tools that we have available to us is really fascinating.
The image that comes to my mind is Willie Nelson's guitar.
Yes.
that thing is beaten to like shred, but that sound is so great.
It's so awesome.
Yeah.
It's so awesome. And, you know, over there in Chicago, of course, you're the home of the AACM, which was one of the great pioneering improvisation groups from the 1960s on.
Mm-hmm.
And all these great musical artists like Roscoe Mitchell and Mahal Richard Abrams and Douglas Ewart and so many others. And, you know, taking music out of the realm of the perfect jazz performance or the perfect classical performance or the perfect pop music performance, and instead placing it into a community context where people are really messing with the sound and messing with the instruments and the tools and the electronics and finding all these surprising things that they can do.
In a moment, I'm going to ask you for a yes and story, which is like the biggest layup in the world for you. But before we do that, I was in my office doing notes for the podcast, and I had just come from a conversation with a couple of my colleagues about Second City teaching storytelling, which we do. And we were sort of saying, you know, I want to relook at how we teach storytelling because we've brought in so many other elements of storytelling from Joseph Campbell and other great stuff, fantastic stuff.
Yeah.
But we have a very particular kind of ethos because of our improv-based storytelling that I think can be more authentic to a real Second City experience. And I read this quote to them and they loved it, which is, quote, "The important thing isn't to tell the perfect story. It is to tell the story the people in front of you need to hear. To do that, you must first understand who stands before you." I mean, this is great because this is sort of saying, yeah, we're, you know, story's fantastic. But if you don't know who's in front of you, and by the way, getting to know who's in front of you is a little bit of work.
Yeah.
Talk to us a little bit about what, when you think of that and you think of knowing the other, especially in a sort of improvisational context, what do you go to? What's the kind of, you know, way that you figure that person out who's across from you?
Oh, that's so complex.
Yeah, I know. But give me a couple.
When it's complex, it's complex. And when it's easy, it's easy.
Yeah.
But you know, one of it's absolutely fascinating in my life how many times I have had the pleasure of reading people well and just as it were, just grooving right in with them and being able to connect immediately, and how many times I have misread people and thought that I was seeing a certain kind of response, and in fact, it was really quite different because I just didn't pick up the little clues.
Yeah.
And the little clues are intuitive, they're subtle. what, you know, that, and actually that's one of the reasons I like sound theater and sound art, because we are communicating at a basic emotional level. But often when we communicate with words, you might say a word that means something to you and something somewhat similar but really different to me.
Yeah.
And I'll mishear it. So I can't say that I have a magic formula for looking at another person across the room and saying, okay, I got it. Now I know who I'm talking to.
Right.
But the intention or the desire to do that, even if you don't always do it well, is what's really important.
Right. The idea of remaining curious, and the behavioral scientists that we work with at the University of Chicago, their research shows that, you know, we actually are wrong more than right in terms of assuming what other people are thinking. And their offer is to ask a lot of questions. And
yeah,
for me, that's so interesting, because, you know, in improvisation, we actually teach people not to ask a lot of questions on stage. But it's less about that specific thing of asking questions, more of engage and re-engage.
Yeah.
And re-engage.
Yeah.
And when you do that, you know, the people start to, you know, be vulnerable, and their real self starts to show up, and yours does too.
And they'll ask questions back.
Yes, yes. And the knowing is collaborative.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. All right. I could talk to you forever, but we don't have time.
Well, we will some more.
We will some more. But I wonder if you can give us a yes and story, a time from your life where you normally would have said no, but instead you said yes and.
Well, there is a, and I want to add another one to this, but
sure.
In the book, there's a yes and story from my life that's the chapter that is the basis for the chapter called Interruptions and Offers. And I'm a violinist. I was practicing in my studio, and it was about 10 years ago when my elder son was a teenager. And suddenly I'm just hearing this enormous house-shaking noise, because he was upstairs and he put on a punk rock record. And I was going, what the heck is this? And I just was so irritated. And I started stomping up the stairs to ask him to turn it down. But, of course, it takes time to stomp up the stairs. And while you're doing that, you start actually, I mean, first of all, there's the thought that, well, he's allowed to have his musical taste that's different from mine. But more than that is, in the period of time it takes to stomp up the stairs, you start actually hearing the music. And I was thinking, oh, this is kind of interesting. I was really stuck in my practice, and I had no idea what I was doing. So halfway up the stairs, I stopped and tried to play along with it. And I just started learning stuff. And then I went back downstairs, and I realized, well, this is a new lesson,
mm-hmm.
a new sound. And so this is really, you know, all of us who are doing any kind of art or any kind of skilled or professional activity at all, you know, we get stuck all the time in ruts.
Yeah.
And, you know, the lesson for me is, you know, I get so irritated. And then 5 seconds later, I realize, well, this irritation is actually the next lesson.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was quite wonderful. And then, of course, I was discovering all kinds of new sounds and to play with. But I was thinking just before, when you asked me about Herbert Zipper,
yeah,
and I talked about Hitler marching into Vienna and imprisoning all the Jews and a lot of other people and destroying the culture that existed there. There's a great story, a much better yes and story than my story, about Sigmund Freud. And Freud, have you heard this about the signature?
No.
So Freud, you know, of course, he was like the Jewish psychiatrist talking about sex, and he was like the ultimate evil in Nazis' mentality.
Mm-hmm.
But he was also world famous, and it would have really not done at all at that stage of the conflict for them to just kill him or throw him in a concentration camp. And he had friends from the international psychiatric community who had come to get him out.
Mm-hmm.
And so a Gestapo colonel walks into Freud's home. Freud is packed up, ready to escape from Austria at the last minute just before the war starts. And the Gestapo colonel says, everything, it was like some of those scenes at the beginning of Casablanca, you know.
Right.
Everything is set for your departure, but you need your exit papers.
Hmm.
And if you want your exit papers, you have to sign this letter. And it was a letter stating that I, Professor Dr. Sigmund Freud, have been well treated by the Third Reich, and I'm mm-hmm. leaving of my own free will for professional reasons, and blah, blah, blah. They wanted to be able to use it for propaganda purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And Freud says, okay, I'll sign this. May I add something at the bottom of the letter? And before the Gestapo colonel can reply, he writes, and of course these were the days before, you know, computer-authored mm-hmm. documents, and he writes, everybody knows that the Gestapo are wonderful guys, and then signs Sigmund Freud.
That's great!
So there it is, you know, and they yeah. had to let him out.
Yeah.
Because, of course, he gave them a very wonderful compliment.
He did.
But, of course, the compliment was so idiotic
right.
that nobody would ever take it seriously, and they could never use this as a propaganda document.
Who knew?
So that's another kind of yes and.
Sure is, and who knew that Freud was funny? That's
yes.
All right. The book is called The Art of Is, Improvising as a Way of Life. Stephen Nachmanovich, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so very much. It was a pleasure to talk about all of this with you, and I was really happy to be able to learn from you as well.
And I you.
Well, I've been working in a coal mine.